Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. This hour, we're going to take an in-depth look at the art of negotiating salary and benefits, jumping off with what women need to bring to the bargaining table. According to the Census Bureau, women still make about 79 cents on the dollar when compared to men doing similar jobs. The so-called care penalty is a huge contributor. Women are still overwhelmingly family caregivers and often elect to go part-time or do flexible hours. But the negotiation process itself is often a scenario in which big dollars can be lost for women. We'll examine why this is happening and ask a provocative question. Do women need to approach bargaining differently than their male peers? Some experts say yes, if they want to get ahead. We'll also look at a forthcoming Philadelphia ordinance, which bars employers from asking about prior salary. So we'll talk about all of this in a few moments. But first, here's the number. If you've got questions or even a story you'd like to relate, if this hits home for you, 888-477-9499 is the number. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So joining us in studio, Nancy Rothbard is a professor of management and chair of the management department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Welcome, Nancy. Welcome back to Radio Times, I should say.
Thank you very much, Mary.
And Hannah Riley Bowles is a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Hello, Hannah.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Nancy.
So suffice it to say, negotiation is of course, crucial to advancement, but it's a tough process. And for women in particular, the process seems to be especially challenging. We'll get into that some more in just a moment. But frankly, many women are even hesitant to begin. Hannah, first to you, you quote a study, of graduating MBA students, which found that half of the men responding had negotiated their job offers, compared to only about 1/8 of the women. Why is that?
Well, what we've discovered is that women are more reticent to negotiate around pay for good reasons. What we've shown in research is that men and women are perceived differently when they attempt to negotiate a higher compensation. So when you're in a negotiation, you're trying to get what you want, like more money, but it also matters, particularly in an employment context, the impression that you make. And so what we found was that both men and women could get the same thing in terms of money, but women were walking away with having made a more negative impression than the men for having engaged in the exact same behavior. So it's very important to communicate to women that if they feel more reticent than men about negotiating for pay, it's not for lack of confidence or skill. It's actually that they're reading the social environment, that this is a little bit tougher for them to pull off successfully than it is for men.
Nancy Rothbard, you want to weigh in?
Well, I think Hannah has done some really terrific work on this, and it's really a pleasure to be on the show with her. But I think that one of the things that's really interesting about women and negotiating is, as Hannah has talked about, a lot of the challenge is also that women sometimes don't even see that there is an opportunity to negotiate. And perhaps it's because they're reading the social cues, but they're self-limiting and not even thinking of the situation as one in which it's a negotiating opportunity. And I think that that also may be part of the challenge.
So Nicole Porter, a law professor at the University of Toledo, writes in the New York Times, simply stated, women have been socialized to believe that asking on their own behalf is a gender norm violation. What is your response to that, Nancy?
Well, there's a lot of research on backlash and the idea that we have gender role stereotypes around what's expected of us as women, as men, as, you know, people in different roles in society. And when we behave in ways that are really counter-normative to that, people don't know what to make of it and they get very upset. And so, you know, negotiating is an agentic behavior. It is behavior where you are often seen as trying to get something for yourself. And when it's perceived in that way, then that's very counter-normative to the gender role stereotypes of women and the expectations we have of women to be warm, to be nurturing, to be caring of others. And so, you know, some of the, I think, great research that Hannah has done has shown that the way you negotiate is really important so that you don't violate those norms. And I'll leave it to Hannah to talk about that more.
Well, Hannah, let me get into a passage written by Tara Siegel-Bernard, and she's quoting some experts. Discrimination can emerge when women act in ways that aren't considered sufficiently feminine. And when women advocate for themselves, some people find it unseemly on a subconscious level. Let's parse this a little bit more. What are we talking about? Women acting in a feminine manner, say if they are going for a job, they're competing for a job that they know a male counterpart is going for as well. How can feminine mannerisms, if you will, hurt as they are going for this job? Or on the flip side, acting in what might be termed an aggressive and perhaps confident manner?
Yeah, so building on what Nancy was saying, it's the act of the feminine ideal, right? Our ideal woman is someone who is a maternal figure, someone who's a caregiver, somebody who puts others ahead of themselves. And so when women are self-advocating, asking for more for themselves, and frankly, I think it's particularly around money, and I can talk about why I think money is special. What happens is that they violate that expectation that they're selfless and just looking out for others and not looking out for themselves. So that's the kind of key violation. Hopefully we'll get into strategies that women can use to avoid that. But it's this asking for more for myself. And then I think particularly asking for more money for myself that violates this feminine ideal. Money is a little special for a variety of reasons. One is because we still have this idea of the male breadwinner. It doesn't actually fit our current American demographics. Two-earner families are a necessity for so many families, and there are so many female-headed households now in the United States. But we still associate men with being the breadwinners and associate, therefore, with kind of making money with being a man and being a male head of household. So I think that when you're asking for more money for yourself, you're violating kind of two norms at the same time. And that's why that's really most of the data that we have on the backlash is really about asking for more money for yourself. It doesn't apply as broadly to different other types of negotiations.
So Hannah Bowles, women need to somehow set aside the perception of the maternal caregiver when they are going for something, whether it's more money, job advancement, et cetera? And is that accurate? And if so, how do you do that? Is there a how-to?
Well, I would actually say the opposite is I think what we've found in our research, and that jives very well with the advice that Sheryl Sandberg would give or other interviews that we've done with female executives who are very effective, is that women actually want to signal their concern for organizational relationships. I would say if it's genuine. I think I wouldn't advise anybody to be inauthentic. But two things that we find a strategy that women can use to get both what they want and make the impression that they want is what I call an I-we strategy. And that is you want to do two things. You want to go in and explain what you want, but you want to explain why it's legitimate or appropriate for you to be negotiating in a way that's persuasive to your negotiating counterpart. And the second thing that you want to do is signal that you are taking their perspective. And what's very interesting is if you're perceived as your request was legitimate and that you are someone who cares about organizational relationships, those were the two explanatory factors that we call mediators, or those were the two factors that predicted instances where women both got what they want and made the impression that they wanted to make in the negotiation.
And quickly, and then I'd like to get Nancy's response. The I-we strategy, is that something you recommend for men as well?
Well, I think the big difference is that men may be able to get away without doing the I-we strategy. But in general, the IWI strategy is just good negotiating advice. I mean, you always, in any negotiation, you want to go in and explain why what you're asking for is legitimate, and you want to show that you're taking on the other side's perspective. I think the biggest difference, I would argue, between men and women is that women have the extra burden of doing that homework. I think it's women really need to do their homework ahead of time going in and practice and think about what their arguments are, maybe more than a guy might need to.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Nancy? We've got to do our homework a little bit more and perhaps change the approach.
So I think that that's really excellent advice. One of the things that I also think is really important when you're going in to negotiate is, as a woman, is to also make sure that you signal how what you're asking for is beneficial to the organization long term, as well as to others in the organization. And I think that there's a lot of ways to do that. If we think about integrative negotiating, where you're trying to create a win-win, you know, if what you're asking for is also beneficial for the organization as a whole, you're able to make that argument. And I do think that that takes a lot more preparation. It takes a lot more thought, and it can sometimes take a lot more care in how you go about it.
All right, we've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Let's get to Laura in Philadelphia. Hi, Laura.
Hi. This is a great discussion. Thank you for having it. So I'm a full-time working mother, in fact, here in Philadelphia. And so my question is, how do we move forward against these stereotypes? How do we change them? I think we saw it at a very high level in the presidential election, the way that culture sort of pushes back on these stereotypes. But we did it. You know, we had a female presidential nominee and who almost won. And so I tell women that I mentor, and I try to keep as a rule for myself, if you don't ask for it, you won't get it.
Yeah.
But what research is out there, or what advice would you have for people in these situations, and how do you think it will change?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Nancy?
So I think that one of the things you said was really quite spot on there, which is if you don't ask for it, you won't get it. And I think that the key there is ask. And the tone and the way that you talk about what you want with somebody really makes a difference in terms of these backlash issues. And, you know, the difference between demanding and asking, having a conversation where you're solving a problem versus a demand. And what I have found is that when women are having a problem-solving conversation, when they're asking, when they are, you know, coming in with great preparation and great thoughtfulness about the topic, they make a lot more headway. And as Hannah said earlier, you know, some of these strategies, it's not that they won't work for men as well. They'll work for both genders. It's just that for women, we need to be aware that sometimes we need to ask in a way that's going to really get through to other people.
Hannah, we've got about 30 seconds before the break, but is there a time to demand, especially if you see something on the job that might not be right or fair? Or equitable?
I think, of course, that's right. I think if you get to that point, I think you want to reach out and build alliances. I think you want to get advice. I think I would think you'd be in a much stronger position not being alone doing that. If I were going to go in and felt like I needed to demand something, I would make sure I'd sought advice from allies and senior folks within the organization for advice on how to do that, and to walk in making sure that people understood that my perspective was not just my own and I was not just demanding only for myself.
All right, Hannah, we're up against the break. We'll get Nancy's perspective in just a moment here on Radio Times. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, along with Nancy Rothbard, professor of management and chair of the management department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Hannah Riley Bowles, a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School. We're talking about salaries, negotiation for better pay, for more flexibility at work, for advancement. We've started off the discussion talking about women, but really we're opening it up to any, you know, women and men as well, in how to best negotiate and to advance in your career. And going into the break, we were talking about, again, if a woman feels she may needs to kind of demand a change in her work situation, what is the risk of backlash, and what does backlash sometimes look like, Nancy?
So I think that the question about demanding is a really interesting one, because I think it's really important to keep in mind that nobody likes it when people are demanding things of them, whether you're a man or a woman. And so the way that you go about the request is really important. And so, for example, you can be assertive and persistent, but not demanding. And if you do need to really push something, I love the strategy that Hannah talked about getting allies, building a coalition. Very, very important for showing the legitimacy of what you're doing and showing it's not just you alone. And so you'd also asked about what are you, you know, how do you then go about this without backlash? And I think that the real key is recognizing that the other party has a perspective as well, and that you are going into a conversation with somebody with your own perspective and that you have to get across, but you have to have a problem-solving conversation with them. You have to get to the heart of the matter, the root of the conflict that sometimes underlies when negotiation is required.
Is it important to know going into a negotiation, a salary negotiation, what your peers are making? It's something that most people don't talk about in the workplace, but Hannah, what's your perspective on that?
I think having that type of information is extremely important. Nancy made a very important point earlier that sometimes women may not perceive opportunities to negotiate. And what research shows is that when negotiation situations are ambiguous, meaning you're not clear about how to negotiate, what to negotiate, or even much about the person you're negotiating with, there's more potential for gender to influence the outcome of the negotiation. Part of that relates to social networks, where we get our information, right? So, for instance, if women only ask their girlfriends how much they get paid when they try to figure out how much to ask for themselves, and men tend to ask their guy friends, and men are on average paid more than women, men and women may walk into negotiations with different expectations of what they can get out of it.
Sure.
So I think it's really important not only to ask some folks how much they're paid, but make sure that you're getting information that's not actually biased by gender or biased just by your friendship network, that you go to folks to give them a broader sense of what's appropriate to ask for in this negotiation in terms of compensation, but also in terms of other things. One other thing related to this is that there's some research showing that this effect of women being more reticent about negotiating than men goes away when both men and women have a clear expectation about what's expected from the employer. So if, for instance, graduating MBA students get information that this employer is, you know, expects them to negotiate, it's a competitive work environment, et cetera, under those conditions, there's less of a gender difference or minimal gender difference as compared to another situation where they just say, you're about to enter, there's an opportunity for you to negotiate with an employer, and the male and female MBAs don't really know what's exactly is appropriate or expected.
Yeah. Back to the question of determining how much a peer makes. It's an awkward conversation. What's the opening line, Nancy?
Well, I've actually done this a lot in my career with colleagues, and there's different ways that you can do it. So, and it of course depends on as Hannah said, the network you're in and the relationships you have. It is awkward for some people. Being somebody who's taught negotiations for years, I became very comfortable with this, and so it became less awkward for me. But you know, you find people who, you know, are in comparable positions, and you try and that you have enough of a relationship with that you can say, look, you know, let's trade information. Let's, you know, better both of us. And, you know, it would be really helpful for me to know ballpark, what the salary ranges are. And so that's what I have done. And actually, I had somebody who did this where they were being promoted and they wanted to know what kind of equivalent positions of people were. Mm-hmm. And they basically collected information from a lot of people. And their promise was that they would then, if you gave them your information, they would give you the whole range.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that everybody would benefit from the collective information.
It's all in the approach. A lot of it. All right. We've got a lot of calls to get to. So, Monica in Havertown, you are now live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great topic. I guess my what I want to offer is more of a comment. I would love to hear your guest's comment on the idea that for women negotiating in the workplace or, you know, asking for what they want or what they deserve is affected by gender, but it's also affected by race. Mm-hmm. I'm a woman of color, and I think that there's that additional dynamic and a different way of negotiating or thinking about negotiating or prepping for negotiation and adjusting to a workplace that may be more male-dominated or, you know, adhere to certain gender norms as well as sort of racial norms. And I think it's important to kind of consider that and that maybe, I don't know if how your advice might change or sort of be nuanced to consider women of color in that dynamic.
All right. Nancy?
I think that Hannah's really the expert on this. So I'm going
to toss it to Hannah. Okay,
yeah.
Hannah.
No, that's fair. You know, there are a number of folks who have tried to look at intersections of gender and race, and I can't say that we've got clear results at this point. When it comes to self-advocacy, asking for more for yourself, I really haven't seen any clear results showing that the race or the ethnicity of the woman is going to make a difference. There are some other studies showing that, for instance, the leadership style of an African-American woman may be perceived differently and in some ways more positively than the leadership than an assertive leadership, the same sort of leadership style by a white woman. But when it comes to this career advancement, self-advocacy stuff, there I don't really think we have any clear results to show that race makes a difference. Yeah. But where it could make a difference is going back to that social networks, you know, that process that Nancy described of how do you get information, being close enough to a variety of people at work to get advice, not only to figure out how much people are paid, but what can you negotiate for and how should you negotiate, or having close enough relationships with people at work for them to advocate for you while you're in the process of negotiating with the organization. And that's something that I'm confident could be affected by not only gender but also race if you find yourself in the racial minority or ethnic minority of your organization.
All right, Monica, thanks for the call. Staying on the subject or this line of thinking for one more moment, Hannah, we've got a comment from Clay who says it seems like African-American men have the same problem that women have when asking for higher salaries. When we show confidence, it is not accepted. Again, I don't know if you have any research at your fingertips to address this, but I wanted to get Clay's comment in.
I trust Clay's intuition on that. We don't have clear data on African American men and negotiating for pay. We do have some other data that we collected actually in the Middle East, looking at Arab men in the Middle East applying for jobs in global corporations. So for a global employer in say the Arab Gulf, hiring one of the Arab Gulf nationals, they're considered kind of like affirmative action hires, the men. And we find very similar dynamics when we study that situation as we do for the situation of women here in the United States or over in the Gulf, that there appears to be an expectation that the men both signal their concern for organizational relationships as well as ask for what they want, that they have to do kind of what we expect of women, of both, you know, communicate that, you know, I have concern for my relationships within the organization. I'm somebody you can get along with.
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting about this is a lot of this gender stereotype that women be agreeable, cooperative, concerned about others is actually related to women's status in society. Women, there's a traditional association of women being in kind of staff roles and caregiving and support roles. And there's also a tradition of men of color also being in staff or subordinate roles.
Yes.
And we expect of people in those subordinate roles to be agreeable because that helps maintain the system. So I have a feeling although I don't have clear data, I have a feeling that his intuition is correct.
Here's a quote from Linda Babcock, a professor at Carnegie Mellon and founder of its gender equity program. She says, at least of women, it's totally unfair because we don't require the same thing of men, and that means changing and differing the approach. But if women want to be successful in this domain, they need to pay attention to this. Even as, I mean, are you gritting your teeth sometimes, Nancy, when we think about having to do it differently?
I think that we all are frustrated by this, right? Because it's a double bind, right? It's an extra burden on women to, you know, prepare more, to, you know, do more going into the negotiation, to be making sure that we're maintaining our agreeable demeanor during the negotiation. So it's a lot more work. But I think that understanding that the alternative is that we're often not going to get what we want if we're not going to do this is really important to temper our frustration sometimes with the situation.
Let's take a look for a moment at legislation passed by Philadelphia City Council, which would bar employers from asking job applicants about prior salaries, how much they made in their old jobs. In reading this information, the point was made that this should help women and minorities. How so, Nancy?
Well, I think that one of the things that this legislation does is it tries to even the playing field, because with any negotiation, you have what's called an information asymmetry problem where, you know, one side knows information, the other side doesn't, right? And you're trying to resolve that information asymmetry. When the employee is required to give their former salary as part of the application process, that really puts them at a disadvantage in terms of the employer knowing a lot more information than the employee knows what's possible. And so that it's trying to really create the opportunity for women and minorities and men to be able to actually negotiate for the salary that they deserve based on the merits of the position and the comparables of the position, not what they've been paid in a prior job.
And Mayor Kenney is expected to sign this legislation. Hannah Riley Bowles, worth noting, the Greater Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce was against this legislation. Rob Wenderling is the chamber's president, and he told the Philadelphia Inquirer that asking for salary history can help a manager decide if a candidate is worth pursuing. Is this a legitimate part of the process?
Well, I think past pay is not relevant. I mean, what's relevant is what you can get if you walk away from the table. The basic negotiator's problem is to compare what they're being offered as to compare what they can get if they walk away. And so for the employer, what they need to think about is, could I hire a comparably talented employee for less money? And what the candidate or the prospective employee needs to think about is, could I get a comparably attractive job for more pay? What somebody has been paid in the past is not actually relevant to that market problem. I can appreciate that employers might want to have that information because it helps them anchor the negotiation lower, and it might also give them some information about how much the employee could make if they were on the job market. But it's not. I'm in favor of suppressing this information because it isn't actually directly relevant to the negotiation.
All right, we're taking calls at 888-477-9499, and Danielle in Doylestown has been standing by. Welcome, Danielle.
Hi. Thanks. Great conversation.
Thanks.
I have a question. Have there been any studies about the differentiation in response rates depending on the gender of the interviewer, the boss? The presumption seems to be that it's most likely male interviewing because those tend to be the power holders and stakeholders. But are there any studies done on that factor? Because to make a parallel, I was surprised that so many women, white women in particular, voted against their sort of representational figure in Hillary Clinton. And I'm just wondering if the boss is a male versus a female, do they have some sort of subconscious bias, or what are the reaction rates?
Boy, that's an interesting question. Thanks, Danielle. Hannah Riley Bowles, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, I can give you the answer on that. I mean, particularly evaluating women, there really aren't any effects depending on the gender of the evaluator or the interviewer. Unfortunately, we're exposed to these stereotypes. And as indicated by that quote that you read earlier by Tara, I think a lot of these things happen non-consciously. I think, you know, the people in our study who in our studies who've shown backlash toward women who negotiate, I'm not persuaded that they do it in some conscious sense, some sense that this woman I just watched on a video needs to be punished for her behavior. I think they just get a kind of yuck feeling, or they get they find the behavior aversive, and they may not be fully consciously in touch with it. So unfortunately, there really isn't evidence that the gender of the person with whom you're negotiating makes a difference. It's about these stereotypes that we from society that we've absorbed. But on a more positive note, can I go back to a question of the by Laura, the earlier caller, saying, mm-hmm. how do we change this, yeah. right? And the reason why we expect women to be paid less than men, or consciously or unconsciously, and the reason why we're more likely to expect men to rise to leadership positions than women is because men tend to be paid more than women, and because men are in more leadership positions or more likely to ascend to leadership positions than are women. So, I mean, folks like Hillary Clinton, who did win the popular vote and has been the first viable female candidate for president, and folks like Laura and I imagine Danielle, who are in their workplace, are role models. They're the people, as they rise in their organizations, who are going to be changing expectations about women's leadership potential and what they should be paid.
So I sense some optimism from you, Hannah.
Yes, I really am.
One quick comment before we get to the break here. We've got an email from Robert who asks, is there an association between social economic status and negotiation skills? He says, I grew up in poverty and never had the opportunity to negotiate my salary or benefits until my mid-40s.
Is there any information available on that immediately in Nancy Rothbard?
I mean, I think that it intuitively it makes a lot of sense yeah. in that you don't necessarily have the tools because you don't have the social networks, as Hannah was talking about earlier, to kind of have a sense for what the options are. You don't have as many options. And one of the things that is really critical in negotiating is having options. So if you just have one opportunity, you're going to be much, much less able to negotiate with that employer because you don't have a lot of other options.
Nancy Rothbard is professor of management and chair of the management department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Hannah Riley Bowles is senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School. We are looking about the gender wage gap, why women are less likely to ask for more money, and also on a broader stage, just thinking about salaries and the ways to negotiate. So more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about salaries, why so many of us feel underpaid, and the challenges in negotiating better pay, whether it's a raise or more flexibility at work. And we're also talking about the gender wage gap and why women are often less likely to ask for more money. Our guests this hour, Hannah Riley Bowles, who is senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School, and Nancy Rothbard is professor of management and chair of the management department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And we've been getting a lot of calls. We've got time for some more, so if you'd like to call in, 888-477-9499 is the number. You can also send us a comment, an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So let's get down to some of the nuts and bolts in successful negotiation. And we're talking about both both genders, women and men. Number one, in tooling around for some, you know, looking at this prep, number one I came across, don't sit around thinking someone is going to notice the good work you do. And apparently this is something that many women tend to do. They'll notice me and therefore I will be advanced. Doesn't work without opening your mouth, I guess. Hey, Nancy?
So I think that's a really interesting quote there. The thing that is really important in any negotiation, as I started to discuss before the break, is first you need to do your homework. You need to know what your options are. You need to know what the opportunities are out there, how other people have potentially pursued those opportunities, what the range is for salary, what the options are in terms of the other benefits, the flexibility, et cetera. And you have to really do a lot of work on that front. And I think that that's one thing. The great thing about that, the thing that makes me really optimistic, is anybody can do it. It doesn't matter about your style, right? You can put the work in. It is simply a matter of effort and really scanning the options. The second thing that you need to do is you need to increase, as I said, your options earlier, and knowing that maybe you need to pursue more than one opportunity. And that's sometimes very hard for both men and women to consider. They get very locked in and wedded to one particular path. And thinking about what the multiple options you have are can be really, really important for helping to free you up and give you some leverage in negotiating.
So say you have you want to stay at your organization, mm-hmm. but you've got an appealing offer from the outside. What is the best way to bring that to the table without risking backlash?
Right. So I think that that's always a tricky thing people may worry about. The first thing that you need to do is be very happy that you have gotten that outside interest.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I actually had a colleague who once told me, you know, when I was talking about, well, how do I bring up, you know, good information that's happened without seeming like I'm bragging or, you know, that it would be negatively received. And what she said to me was, you know, well, you know, when people say, hi, how are you doing? You say, I'm great. I'm really excited. Like, you know, this new opportunity just, you know, came about. I really wasn't looking for it, but, you know, I got a call. And, you know, I want some advice about what you think I should do.
Yeah. Hannah, what do you think?
Oh, I agree with everything that Nancy said. I think that's right. I think you want to. I mean, we did a bunch of studies where we were looking at how women can. We originally thought that if a woman had an outside offer, this whole backlash business would just go away. And
no.
We ran a whole bunch of studies, and it didn't. It didn't go away. But I like Nancy's approach of saying, I'd like to get some advice. I think this is a moment where you might also want to, again, tap your network, get advice from a variety of people in the organization about this has happened, how should I approach it, how should I talk to the organization. You know, not only would you be in that process potentially getting some great advice, you might also then be developing some allies, some other people who can say, you know, she really does want to stay with the organization. We need to think about keeping her, et cetera, so that the onus is not only on you to make that case.
How do you best determine when it is to jump ship? If you've got that offer, what are some of the determining factors, Hannah?
Well, I think you'd want to look a lot farther than just the offer. So I think you want to look at more than just money. I think you want to look at what your career path looks like in the two organizations, and how each of those paths also would appeal to your broader life goals. So that if you do make a decision to shift, that you're going to a place where you anticipate longer-term success. I mean, there's actually an interesting study by a guy named a professor at Harvard Business School, Boris Groysberg, and he looked at star analysts. And what he found was that male star analysts, when you become a star analyst, you get all these offers from these other firms, mm-hmm. and the men tended to actually decline in performance or star status after they switched firms,
really?
Whereas that didn't happen for the women. And what he figured out was that the men were mostly chasing higher pay, whereas the women, because it's actually kind of a tough environment for women on Wall Street, that they were doing a lot of investigating. If they were going to switch firms, they were going to find a place where they could thrive. And he thinks it was because of that research, that extra homework that the women did, was why they retained their star status as they moved across organizations.
Well, maybe homework is good advice for the men as well.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to get back to doing good work and not waiting around for somebody to notice it. Nancy, should when you think you've done something well, a project you really enjoy, you think has worked, do we need to keep a log? Do we need to really keep a record of what it is we're doing? So when it comes time to move forward, you can just kind of pull it out and present it?
I mean, I think that would be a really interesting idea. I mean, one of the things that is really important is that I think that people feel like you're also doing this spontaneously and it's not very instrumental. And so one of the things that about the log that I worry about a little bit is, you know, you've got kind of this, you're noting down all of your accomplishments and then you're going to come and present them all at once.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that the more organic approach can be really more, more accepted. So, you know, when my colleague gave me this advice about, you know, how do I talk about these accomplishments, the things that are going well, you know, she said, you know, have people, you know, excited for you and celebrating with you along the way.
Got it.
And, you know, I think that what you can then do is at a later point, you know, you can sum up that. But I think to have people brought along with you so that you're not always the one who is coming to the boss and saying, I've done this, this, and this for you. You have to have other people, sponsors, mentors, people who are allies in the organization saying, you know, Mary has really, you know, she's really been growing and learning and she's been having so much success in all of these areas. We really need to give her a chance.
Yeah.
Right. That's the way you're going to really get those new opportunities.
So building a coalition is extremely important. Yeah. How do you walk in the door at work in the morning with an eye toward doing that? It has to do with, I'm guessing, demeanor, being open to other people if you're going to build a coalition.
Yeah, being engaged with other people, making sure that you're responding to their successes as well. And that they want to exchange those with you and that they feel supported by you as well. People, you know, really value I have a research study on the affect that you bring to the workplace and, you know, the emotional state that you're in when you walk in the door. And it turns out when you walk in the door happier, you're more effective throughout the day. And when you walk in the door in a really bad place, you're less productive. And so, you know, that affective tone and demeanor is, I think, really important for being able to bring people to engage with you, to be really excited with you and for you, and then to get on board and be your allies.
Back to the phones. Lori in Pennsylvania, you are next. Hello, Lori.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I wanted to bring up a factor that hasn't been discussed, and it's the what I call a hard skill. And I'll give my own background, and then I'll talk a little bit about that example. I was a computer programmer in the late 60s and 70s, and that skill just was rare. And even though I'm not particularly a real competent person socially, and it was even less so at the time, I got offers all the time, and I never, like, no one trained me to negotiate or teach me, but after a while, because it was a hard skill, it was just no one could argue about the fact that, you know, this was the amount of money that skill was worth.
Yeah.
So that's my background, but my comment is that I think women are not scared or are unaware of hard skills, and I want to use a different hard skill. What about carpenter? What about plumber? What about electrician? Women don't even go for that type of a job, and they're just typically for the same level of formal education, much higher pay, and they're also, it's much clearer.
Yeah.
Even, I don't know the effect of the unions, but like how much does an electrician get? How much does a plumber get?
Yeah.
How much does a house cleaner get? And of course, how much does a porter get? How much does a kitchen garment get?
Right.
That kind of thing. But it's a very hard skill.
Lori?
Non-negotiable.
You make a good point, and we're going to pass this along now to Nancy. You were nodding your head. I mean, these are some of the fields that women traditionally have not entered, and I know in Philadelphia's Rebuild program, as a matter of fact, they're encouraging women and minority participation, you know, in the construction field, in trying to build some of these businesses. But skills worth having.
So I think that Lori makes a really important point in that your skill is really critical for what you're going to be able to negotiate for. And the rarer that skill is, the more the easier it's going to be to have that negotiation. The more important that skill is, the more core it is to a business. I also want to address this question about, you know, some of these more masculine professions that she was mentioning. I actually did a study of firefighters, which is a predominantly masculine organization, and it was about 97% men, 3% women. You know, out of every 100 men, there were 3 women.
Yeah.
But you know, what's interesting is that it also creates a culture which I think is difficult sometimes for women to enter.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not just women aren't trying to do this. I think that to also recognize that sometimes those environments are not necessarily the most welcoming in that sense. And so, you know, really having to be able to negotiate that kind of environment takes another set of skills as well. And some women are wonderful at doing that and really embrace it. And others are saying, you know what, I'll be a computer programmer.
Well, getting into the boys club, what do you need to bring to the table there?
I mean, I think that takes a really tough skin, and it takes the ability to – so what we found in that masculine organization in firefighting was that there were two predominant cultures, emotional cultures that persisted, which were emotional cultures of joviality, which were teasing, pranks, humor. And that's the one I think it's really hard oftentimes for women to get into. And then there was the other culture that we saw in some of the stations was culture of love, companionate love, which is tenderness, affection, compassion, and caring, which was a little bit surprising in this masculine organization. But when you're able to have both of them, that's where I think women would be able to thrive.
Right. Hannah Riley Bowles, let's get back to the negotiation process. If you do not succeed in getting what you're after, what is the next step? How do you approach?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. Can I build for a moment on what Nancy was saying and going back to the
absolutely.
Caller? I think if you look at studies of the gender wage gap, what you see is that the gender gap in compensation is considerably smaller for younger workers, say 25 to 34. I'm looking right now at a study by the Wall Street Journal that showed that in 2013, the gender wage gap between men and women who are of the ages of 25 to 13 was around 10%. Whereas if you look at the gender wage gap of between men and women in ages 35 to 44, 45 to 54, 55 to 64, it's substantially greater. And that same that pattern is held, over the past 30 years. So it's not just that the older women entered the workforce in a more biased era. What it has a lot to do with is career path. And career path is in part whether women get, end up going into these traditional feminine soft skill type roles. Women will often be encouraged or sort of expected to take these feminine types of jobs that are less well compensated. And then it obviously also relates to, traditional notions of women as caregivers, be it for children or for family. So I just think it's very important that we think also not just about negotiating your pay entering an organization, but about negotiating your career and your career path. And, following some of the advice that Nancy was giving earlier about doing your homework and building your network and getting advice, it's very – when I interview executives about the types of things that they negotiate that are career-related – they don't mention compensation nearly as often as negotiating about the role that they want to play or negotiating for things like professional development, or in the case of women, negotiating for, time or geographic flexibility so that they can play multiple roles that they aspire to play.
Well, and so those points are well taken. We have probably about 45 seconds left. So, we're all going to take some knocks in this process. You get knocked down, you pick yourself back up, you dust yourself off. Again, if you find yourself at a dead end, perhaps in negotiating for a salary or an advancement, what is the next step?
I think that you have to decide how important it is to you, the salary, for example, right? Is it more important that you're in a geographic location that you really want to stay in the type of job you want to be in? And you may really need to start going in and looking and seeing what the options are for you so that you can continue to learn and grow and feel valued in your professional life.
And some final thoughts on that, Hannah?
I agree with you. I think that I agree with what Nancy said, and I think that is also a moment where you have to start looking around. You have to start looking at other job opportunities. I mean, the strength in negotiation is, we often say, determined by our alternatives to where we would go away from the negotiating table. And so I think that's the next step, is to start looking at what those alternatives would be.
Hannah Riley Bowles, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah Riley Bowles is a senior lecturer in public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, and a pleasure as well to you. Thank you so much, Nancy Rothbard.
Thank you, Mary.
Nancy Rothbard is professor of management and chair of the management department at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And this reminder, check out our Facebook page and podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you along for Radio Times.